This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Kurt Black, technical advisor for BATS Northwest, an all-volunteer, not-for-profit organization that works to educate the general public about bats. Kurt was previously an environmental scientist for the EPA. Kurt Black is here today to tell us about Northwest bats, including why they are important and what we can do to protect them. Welcome, Kurt.
Good morning, Diane.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about BATS Northwest?
Sure. We're pretty lucky here to have an organization that's right in Seattle. Most people don't have a local bat organization at their hands. Susan Montana, Kathleen Bander long ago started out this organization, and I would like to give a shout out to John Bassett and Meg Lunham, Barb Bogard, Chris Anderson, the folks that have been locally acting for bats in this area for a long, long time.
Would you say a few words about the goals of BATS Northwest?
It's an organization that works for the protection of bats, education, getting people informed. There's lots and lots of misconceptions about bats. That's a challenge, typically. I almost always try to start with that misconception as far as bats are mammals, they're not birds, they're not rodents. Much more interesting, at least to me, than some of those. They're certainly not vampires, they're not all blind, they don't get tangled in your hair, and they don't all have rabies. So if we can just get that stuff out of the way right off the bat, that's helpful, if I can say off the bat.
What led to your personal interest in bats?
I got started as a caver. So I was with the Cascade Grotto right here in Seattle a long time ago, back in the 70s. I just ended up spending more time with the bat folks. Clyde Singer back then was active both as a caver and doing bat research, and he facilitated my getting much more interested. I've still got his original electronics that he put together for bats, so the acoustic monitoring that we were doing back then.
What has drawn other members of BATS Northwest to their interest in bats?
I think it's a wide range of things. We have folks in there that, say, work for the Washington State Fish and Wildlife Department, all the way to educators. There's bat rehabbers. One of the toughest jobs I think you could pick, rehabilitating bats, is definitely not a part-time activity. It's a very challenging work.
So why are bats important?
The major predators of night-flying insects. If you don't like insects, you ought to like bats. All of our bats eat insects, at least here in Washington State. There's some 1,000 species of bats in the world, and of those, 45 of them live north of Mexico in the North American area. If you don't like pine bark borer beetles and things that are kind of running through our forests right now, that's corn borer beetles, all these things, some $3.7 billion in crop damage is thought to be avoided by the presence of bats in our environment. The economic value moves on into things like disease prevention. West Nile virus is moving through here. If you can minimize the number of mosquitoes flying around carrying it, and that's what these bats are doing.
Would you comment on the role of bats as pollinators?
Sure. It's not so much around here. We've got a couple of species down in Arizona and New Mexico, the Mexican long-nosed bat, a couple of those. But up here, all of our bats are eating insects. But certainly pollination services throughout the tropics is incredibly important, as is seed dispersal. I mean, plants don't have the option of moving around. So they either move their genetic material or they move the actual seeds, usually using bats in this case.
Let's focus now on the bat species that are located in the Pacific Northwest. How varied are the different bat species that we find here?
They are tremendously varied. They're all microbats, so they're much smaller than people think. I mean, Hollywood gives you this image of a bat being, I don't know, 30 feet across or something like that. But all of our bats you could mail with a first-class stamp, at least one at a time. So some of them are hummingbird size. Our pipistrelle, the smallest one we got, would fit between, like, the first knuckle on your thumb, just right over your thumb. It's a very, very small animal. And then on up to our largest bats, a reasonably sized, smaller than your fist still. So there's hoary bats, there's big browns, silver-haireds, pipistrelles, spotted bat, Townsend's bat, pallid bats. Those are kind of the ones that aren't in this other group of the mouse-eared bats or the myotids. And that's a little group of eight of them. Some of them are very hard to tell apart. You essentially can't do it in the hand. You have to fly the bat and acoustically listen to what it's saying, and from those characteristics you can tell which species it is. But if you're just holding it in your hand, we used to think you could tell those apart, but it's just not the case. So we were wrong about half the time.
How common are bats here in Seattle?
BATS Northwest leads bat walks at Green Lake a couple of times a month, and we've never been skunked by bats. They always show up, and they're pretty nice walks anyway, so I've frequently taken a bat detector when I go to parties or when I move around the city, and I try to go places at dusk and listen. And when I eavesdrop, they're just almost always someplace. Wherever I am, there are bats there.
Tell us about the bat detector. How does that work?
Sure. Bats are doing a lot of things with sound, especially in the tropics. The bats that are kind of working on fruit have to be able to carry the fruit and still get their echolocation calls out. So they have a structure, a leaf nose or whatever, that allows them to pump that sound out essentially through their nose, like the sword-nosed bat, Phyllostomidae family. It's a leaf-nosed bat family. But around here, with them eating insects or whatever, they can fly around with their mouths open and sound comes out. They use the same larynx that you have, except that the sounds are much, much higher in frequency, up into the 10 octaves above middle C, although most of our bats are doing things down 30,000 cycles per second and up, but not too far up. There's kind of an arms race or whatever between insects and bats. The higher the frequency they use, the more resolution they've got, but the higher the frequency, the more attenuation there is with space, so they can't see out as far. They also get more information just on fine structures and things. So most of the bats that try to forage in, say, forests use a big frequency sweep from a high frequency down to just above where we can hear frequently. The echolocation piece is just why they are so amazing. And just that they're such tiny little animals that do all this stuff that we do. We look around as primates and have this three-dimensional picture of the world around us. They acoustically illuminate their environment with sound, so their brains are building the same picture, and then they fly through it, and then they collect insects out of that.
Which bat species do we find here in Seattle?
There's a bunch of those myotids and big browns, certainly silverheads. Some of the forested parts of the city, we have some good urban forests here, and so hoary bats would be present. We've certainly captured them in the past. We have set up mist nets in the past at Green Lake and captured some of those bats just to see what was present.
How long do bats live, and how do they adjust to the different seasons?
A lot of times when you try to contrast bats and what people kind of confuse them with, say rodents, the place I go first is how long they live. I mean, most people think a rodent, I don't know, a couple of years worth of life sort of thing. But bats are much, much longer lived creatures. We don't know how old this bat was when it was tagged, but we have a recapture on a bat some 32 years later, so... Some bats out of Russia, another of the same Myotis genus, was 40-some years. So they're much, much longer lived than I think most people think. So they've got this vast accumulation of knowledge about their environment. They seem to be passing that stuff on. They share a lot of information in the fall. They have these big assemblages before they go into a hibernation for the hibernating bats. We've got kind of two groups, bats that seem to migrate out of the region for the winter. Everybody has to eat insects because all of our bats around here eat insects. And if there aren't insects... to the most part in the wintertime, then they've got two strategies. One is to hibernate through the winter, and a group of bats certainly does that, and then another group presumably migrates someplace out of here. Unfortunately, they're too small to put transmitters on, so we can't really follow them like you do with the peregrine falcons and things. These bats, we're just assuming that they go at least to California, possibly Mexico, maybe farther than that. It's hard to know.
Do the bats in the Pacific Northwest only eat insects?
That's correct, yep. You have to get down to New Mexico and Arizona before you start getting some nectar-feeding bats, and then Florida for a fruit-eating bat, one of those Artibius that comes up into Florida.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kirk Black, Technical Advisor for Bats Northwest, a not-for-profit organization that works to educate the general public about bats. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How healthy are bat populations in the Pacific Northwest?
So the population question is a really, really tough one. So I've talked a little bit about bats being hard to study. I mean, they're just the opposite of birds. They're not sitting out there calling out some kind of territorial call constantly. They're actually pretty much silent to us. They're invisible. They work at night. All those things have led to us not knowing nearly as much about them. But to get to the population question, it's really, really tough because we don't have any idea what our bat populations are. We know what species are present, but it would be like trying to know by sitting outside and watching the seagulls fly by during a daytime to get an estimate of what the seagull population is. We get bat passes that we record, but we don't know what the actual population is. To do a population study, you usually do a mark and you capture an organism like a rodent or something like that, which is really easy. Put some peanut butter out, something like that. Anyway, capture, mark, and then release them and then recapture. And statistically, over time, you can get some idea what the population is based on how many of those marked animals get recaptured. Bats are really, really smart and won't fly back into the mist net when you're trying to do this kind of thing. So once you capture a bat, it's just extremely wary about the way you capture it. There are a few exceptions to that. Some of the stuff in the tropics, those nectar-feeding bats, apparently they don't have to be extremely intelligent or wary to sneak up on flowers. So those bats do seem to, as soon as you release them, I've recaptured Glossophaga, the fuzzy-tongued bats down there. But no, not around here. So it's really hard. The question about kind of sustainability and getting into the population piece, a lot of times I'll ask, why aren't there more bats on the endangered species list? It's like, it's really hard to make the case when you don't have population information to get a bat there. So I would say many of them deserve to be there, but we just don't have the information right now.
Are there bats in the Pacific Northwest on the endangered species list?
We don't have any in Washington. The closest we have Townsend's bat, which is certainly a sensitive species. It's a species listed by the state as a species of special concern, but not endangered. That's a bat that if you disturb its roosting habitat, they just disappear. We don't know where they go. Presumably, they were already staying in the best place that they could find. So when we disturb them, we kind of assume that they're going someplace suboptimal after that. So we try to avoid that disturbance stuff because they just disappear. The state has some very nice cameras in some roosts now with those bats that they've been able to set up. And you can watch it on the web, Townsend's big-eared bats.
In what ways are the bats in the Pacific Northwest threatened?
I would say mostly habitat challenges. We are busy clawing our way up into the Cascades. When you think about what this region looked like just 150 years ago, it's completely transformed. We had 150 foot tall trees, just these beautiful, beautiful forests. No one has any idea what kinds of species diversity, what was here then. You know, we have no idea. We've completely changed this landscape. The soils that were here, the thick duff layer, those huge trees. You get some sense of it when you get up around Mount Rainier or whatever in the national park, but the rest of this, it's a very different place now with Himalayan blackberry and just all these invasives that are in the lowland. It's a different place. So I don't know what bats we had, but we certainly have some that are very flexible, willing to live with us in our homes. If you get those vents off the peak of your roof, they will certainly join you up there in the attic because they're looking for heat to rear their young.
Are there other threats to bats in addition to habitat loss?
Unfortunately, there's a whole other area, which is the wind turbine question. The tree roosting bats especially are just inevitably drawn to these high structures in the landscape. That's what they used to use for roosting. So it was always their job to go check out the big tall thing sticking above the landscape and see, you know, if there were some big good flakes of bark hanging off of it that they could snuggle up underneath and spend the day warm in a place that they could rear their pups and that kind of thing. Or if they're migrating, anyway, a place that they can save some energy. The challenge with that now is that these big things on the landscape tend to be wind turbines, and especially on the ridge tops and that kind of thing. So these bats, especially on the East Coast where they're migrating out of the area, especially hoary bats. Luckily, they're ones that have twins, but the take on those is, there's different estimates or whatever, but maybe 600,000, half a million bats a year being killed by these wind turbines. It's kind of a Cuisinart for bats. They don't actually have to be hit by the blade. There's a near vacuum behind the blade. The blade tips, they're so big, they look like they're not turning very fast and the bat could get out of the way. But I've done the math. There's just a few milliseconds that the bat has to respond, and there's no way that the area it illuminates with its acoustic energy as it's looking around, looking in the darkness, is just not going to see this thing coming. And they're hard to study again. If your heart's not in it, you may not find the bats that are underneath your wind turbine. So there's just been a lot of challenges with both getting the numbers, the industry. It's certainly a good thing. We need other ways to get energy than digging it up out of the ground and turning it into carbon dioxide. So that this is certainly one path. At the same time, they're clearly taking a toll on birds and bats.
Is the wind industry taking steps to reduce the amount of killing of bats and birds?
There's certainly programs in place. Right now, we're having trouble just agreeing on the numbers or whatever. It's highly variable, location to location, individual wind turbine. There's stuff that they're working on as far as curtailment, especially during the migrating season when these hoary bats, especially on the East Coast, are moving along these ridgetops, encountering these turbines. So as far as actually studying how many bats are out there, I threw out that number, 600,000. There's lots and lots of questions about it. It's a challenging thing because, I mean, the best practices involve, like, training dogs very carefully to go out, sniff up these areas. The bats can be thrown or flung a long way from these turbines. So there's a huge search type job. If you don't get out there early, other scavengers come in, the carcasses are removed. The dogs are highly trained. They certainly do a good job, but there's only so much area they can cover. Even when they do salting of an area with some bat carcasses that they know how many are out there, they have to kind of adjust the number that the dogs are finding based on kind of their success rate.
Would you speak about white nose syndrome and how it has affected bats in the United States?
Sure. Unfortunately, we had a commercial cave in upstate New York back in 2006 where they observed a number of dead bats out in front of this cave in the middle of winter. Bats were flying around. It was a very strange thing. And it turned out that there's this new fungus that had gotten to North America, Pseudogymnoascus anyway, destructans. It's led now to the death of some 6 million bats. When I was contrasting bats and their longevity, another piece of that is that they have extremely low reproductive rates. A rodent can produce a litter of, 11 or so pups. A bat does one pup a year, typically. Some of our species do, too. So very low fecundity, very low reproductive rates, coupled with this disease. It's looking like, some of the models show our most common little brown bat possibly going extinct in North America. It just depends on whether there's some resistance that is building up now. Is there a population that actually can handle this fungus? If they can handle it, is it something that's a heritable trait that they can pass on to their young? And then can they breed fast enough to overcome the death rate?
How far has the white nose syndrome spread so far across the U.S.? And how about Washington State?
Well, it looks inevitable as far as it's heading this way. This winter it got to Michigan and Wisconsin. That was documented. So now it's in 23 states and 5 provinces. It's just marching or burning across North America. A little difference in some of the species' response to it, but Indiana bats, some 70% mortality. Our most common little brown bat has something like 90% mortality. And then certain species like the northern long-eared bat is like 99% mortality. So it's definitely not good for bats. It was very unfortunate that it got here.
How susceptible are the bats in Washington State likely to be to white nose syndrome?
There were a couple of groups of bats. We talked about the hibernating bats being the ones that are sensitive to white nose syndrome. Luckily, not all of our bats hibernate. So we have this whole other group that migrates out of the region to go chase after insects throughout the winter. So those migratory bats, or the tree roosting bats, a lot of times we call them, you would think that they'd be pretty safe then. At least they're not trying to hibernate. As soon as their body temperatures drop, they're susceptible to this fungus.
What steps are being taken to prevent the spread?
There's certainly very active research going on. And if you go to white nose syndrome or Google it or whatever, there's a lot of work. But it's a very difficult thing once a naive species or a naive population gets exposed to something new like this. You kind of have to sit back as an ecologist and watch it happen. There's so much important work that fungi do out there that you can't just spread fungicides or something. People say, well, just coat the caves with some kind of fungicide. And that's not the path.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kurt Black, technical advisor for Bats Northwest, a not-for-profit organization that works to educate the general public about bats. What can we as individuals and as a society do to help bats?
There's so much. The threats of urban sprawl, that kind of thing, if you can protect wilderness, connect those chunks that you have protected so that wildlife can move from one to the next, those kinds of ideas, that kind of makes an assumption that the bats that we're working with are linked to wilderness. And that's certainly not the case in many, many cases. We have lots of bats that live with us right here in our homes, in our walls, even skyscrapers and things downtown. So I can hear them flying by when I do monitoring at night in town. So they're here with us. If there are insects out, then typically the bats are there. If you're someplace where you can see swallows feeding in the daytime, the night shift comes out when the bats are out there. There are things individuals can do, certainly, with bat houses, replacing roosting habitat that's been lost by logging, taking these big trees that used to be everywhere and now are very, very few and far between. Bat houses help us to recreate that thermal environment of the big snags, put them in open areas. There's a lot of stuff we try to do to get them to absorb more heat, things like painting them black. You make them really, really well as far as caulking them and screwing them together kind of thing as you're building them. It's not like little kids can put together birdhouses kind of thing in a project. Bat houses are kind of a higher construction standard. So you have to be able to turn it upside down, fill it up with water, and it ought to be able to hold the water, that kind of stuff. And then where you place it's pretty important. So there's a lot of information on the Bats Northwest website. There's a whole Bat House Central section in there for locating it, putting it out in the open, baking in the sun. It's going to be hot in there. They would be up in your attic if they could be, more than 100 degrees. They're trying to stay where they're not putting any metabolic energy into keeping their bodies warm. All the energy goes into feeding their pups, the one young a year they have, getting the pups up to a point where they can fly, and then they can forage, and then they can put on enough weight that they're going to be able to make it through the next winter as they hibernate. So it's quite a challenging thing for these animals to do.
What are the threats to humans from bats?
Well, bats are our only rabies vector species. So Washington State, if you're going to get rabies, it's going to be a bat variant rabies. It might be brought to you by your cat if your cat's not vaccinated for rabies. But for the most part, if people want to avoid rabies, it's pretty easy. You just don't interact with bats. So interacting would be picking them up and that kind of thing. So when we do work on bats, it's like a 0.1 to 0.3 or 1 in 1,000 to maybe 3 in 1,000 of them are rabid as they fly by. If you pick a bat up off the sidewalk, you've increased your chances of encountering a rabid bat by a factor of maybe 50 or so. It's way more likely that a downed bat has something clearly wrong with it. We just don't usually encounter bats. So same thing with your cat. So if your cat's going to bring you something, it's probably not going to be a healthy bat. It's going to be something wrong with it. So rabies is easily avoidable. Just teach your kids not to pick up bats. Keep your pets vaccinated. And those of us who work on them all have our pre-exposure rabies vaccinations.
What if you find bats in your house, in your attic, for example?
A bunch of us at Bats Northwest would be really, really happy to have such a gift, but a lot of homeowners don't want to coexist with them. We also agree that if the bats are getting down into the living area sort of thing, then indeed you should take some kind of action in the wintertime and do some exclusion work. So it's not hard. Bats are not rodents, so they don't chew. They're not going to chew their way into your attic or your wall spaces and stuff. They need to find a kind of natural opening. So it's pretty easy to, on a winter day with snow outside sort of thing, I've worked my way through many an attic, finding where the light was coming in and walking along with some spray foam, the urethane foam, expanding foam insulation stuff, and just spraying at those cracks and excluding the bats. We try to do that in the winter so that we don't end up trapping bats inside and certainly not pups and that kind of thing. Plus, those attics are really, really hot. That's why they're up there. So it's a nice place not to work in the summertime.
Well, you said a bit about this earlier, but what's the best way to find and view bats?
At Bats Northwest, there's a whole series of talks, especially bat walks at Green Lake Park. It's at least twice a month that there's viewing opportunities. Green Lake is a jewel in the city of Seattle. When you think about nature and cities, there's a real challenge as far as water availability. So this big lake sitting out here is a magnet for wildlife and certainly bats as well. The bats have spent their whole day sitting up in an attic someplace baking in the sun, 100 degrees. The first thing they want to do is go out and get a drink. So they come out of wherever they've been roosting for the day and head towards some body of water. In most cities, they're few and far between. Seattle, we've got just a few of them, and Green Lake is one of them, just an amazing place. So we have bats pouring through the trees. We tend to be out by the what we call the Bat House Theater or the Bathhouse Theater on that little grassy knoll. And just the group assembles there. You've got some good skylight to the northwest, and you just watch as the bats pour through the trees, the opening there, and head towards the lake. So we usually have some acoustic monitoring equipment so we can hear what the bats are saying because they're silent to us unless we use some kind of equipment to move those frequencies down to where we can hear them. And then we frequently do some time expansion work as well. So you expand the calls by a factor of 10, and you can actually hear the structure of the call and that kind of thing. And then we can put it onto some software and analyze it and figure out what species of bat typically it is.
What is some of the research going on in regard to bats of the Pacific Northwest?
I mentioned a little bit about the Bat Grid project. That was a protocol to go out and sample a set amount of effort as far as like how many hours of mist nets are up, how much acoustic monitoring you're doing at the same place over and over again, spread all over. It was kind of a randomized grid pattern that was done for the state, and we've now selected all these places where we try to go back and do the same protocol year after year and then add some different ones. But we're kind of populating these curves of which species have we detected, and as the curves kind of flatten out, you figure you've heard just about everybody who's there. So Washington State's got these 15 species, and a lot of the rich habitats have quite a few of those, so you can get as many as, say, 11 or so in one place.
What resources are available for people who would like to find out more about bats?
I would suggest things like the Bats Northwest website is certainly one. Going on these bat walks is another. Bat Conservation International is a wonderful source of information. They have a great citizen science program that goes on where they're actually collecting data from people who have bat houses, including if your bat house is not working, they still want to hear from you. So, you know, send that data in too, because then we can figure out what it is about that bat house that's not attractive to bats. Typically, it's about how high they are, how hot they're getting, that kind of thing, how well they're made, but especially height. If the bats have to kind of fall and begin to fly with a low swoop kind of thing as they come out of the house. And if that swoop zone overlaps with the leap zone of a cat, they're just not going to take that kind of risk. So the occupancy goes way, way up the higher the bat house gets.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, there are a lot of things you can do, I would say. You can enhance roosting habitat, but there are some large-scale steps. I mean, things like just voluntary simplicity, work for peace. You know, I would say the empowerment of women actually would be helpful. Population in general, I think, is the probably number one problem. There are way too many primates in this box. Any population biologist would say we are just waiting for a virus right now. And actually, there's one happening in equatorial Africa. So maybe the time has come. But anyway, there are many, many better ways to get out of this than just letting our population grow until something has to harvest us. We can be smarter than that.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Kurt. You are just listening to Kurt Black, Technical Advisor for Bats Northwest. For more information, check on the web at batsnorthwest.org. Again, that's batsnorthwest.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.